Philip turned toward Tony. Leibniz was a German philosopher of the 17th century.
I'm finding this tedious and presumptuous, said Pam. Under the guise of helping Julius, you...
She raised her voice an octave.
Philip, I'm talking to you.
Philip, who had been tranquilly staring upward, jerked upright and turned toward Pam.
First you pass out this sophomoric assignment, and now try to control the group by coyly withholding your interpretation of the passage.
Here you go again, trying to deball Philip, said Gil. For God's sake, Pam, he's a philosopher and counselor. You don't need to be a rocket scientist to figure out that he'll try to contribute to the group by drawing from his own expertise. Why begrudge him everything?
Pam opened her mouth to speak but closed it, seemingly at a loss for words. She stared at Gil, who added,
You asked for straight feedback, Pam. You got it. And no, I've not been drinking, if that's what you're thinking. I'm in my 14th day of sobriety. I've been meeting with Julius twice a week. He's turned on the heat, tightened the screws, and got me going to an AA meeting every day, 7 days a week. 14 meetings in 14 days. I didn't mention it last week because I wasn't sure I could stick it out. All of the members, save Philip, reacted strongly with nods and congratulations. Bonnie told him she was proud of him. Even Pam managed a good for you. Tony said,
Maybe I should join you. He pointed to his bruised cheek. My boozin' leads to bruisin'.
Philip, how about you? You got a response for Gil? Asked Julius.
Philip shook his head.
He's already had a good bit of support from others. He's sober, speaking out, gaining strength. Sometimes more support is less.
I like that motto of Leibniz's you cited. Caritas sapientis. Wisdom and care, said Julius. But I urge you not to forget the caritas part. If Gil deserves support, why should you always be last in line? And what's more, you've got unique information. Who else but you can express your feelings about his coming to your defense and confronting Pam on your behalf?
Well said, responded Philip. I have mixed feelings. I liked Gil's support, and at the same time, I'm wary of liking it. Rely on others to do battle for you, and your own musculature will atrophy.
Well, I'm gonna reveal more of my ignorance, said Tony, pointing to the handout. This boat story, Philip? I really don't understand it. You told us last week you were going to give Julius something comforting, and yet this story about a boat and passengers, I mean to put it bluntly, I don't know what the fuck gives here.
Don't apologize, said Bonnie. I told you, Tony, that you almost always speak for me. I'm as confused as you are about this ship and gathering shells.
Me too, said Stuart. I don't get it.
Let me help, said Pam. After all, interpreting literature is how I earn a living. First step is to go from the concrete, that is, the ship, the shells, the sheep, and so on, to the abstract. In other words, ask yourself, what does this ship or voyage or harbor represent?
I think the ship stands for death, or the journey toward death, said Stuart, glancing at his clipboard.
Okay, said Pam. So where do you go from there?
Seems to me, Stuart replied, the main point is, don't pay so much attention to details on shore that you'll miss the boat sailing.
So, said Tony, if you get too caught up in that shore stuff, even having a wife and kids, then the boat might sail without you. In other words, you might miss your death. Big deal, is that such a catastrophe?
Yeah, you're right, Tony, said Rebecca. I also understood the boat to be death, but when you put it that way, I see it doesn't make sense.
I don't get it either, said Gil. But it doesn't say you'll miss death. It says you'll go to it trussed up like the sheep.
Whatever, said Rebecca.
but this still doesn't feel like therapy.
She turned to Julius.
This is supposed to be for you. Do you find any comfort in this?
I'll repeat what I said to you last week, Philip. What I get is the knowledge that you want to give me something to ease my ordeal, and also that you shy away from doing that directly. Instead, you choose a less personal approach. Sets a future agenda, I think, for you to work on expressing your caring in a more personal way. As for the content, Julius continued, I'm confused also, but this is how I understand it. Since the boat might sail at any time, that is, since death could call us at any point, we should avoid getting too attached to the things of the world. Perhaps it warns us that deep attachments would make dying more painful. Is this the message of consolation you're trying to give me, Philip?
I think, Pam interjected before Philip could answer, that it falls into place better if you think of the ship and the journey not as representing death, but what we might call the authentic life. In other words, we live more authentically if we keep focused on the fundamental fact of sheer being, the miracle of existence itself. If we focus on being, then we won't get so caught up in the diversions of life, that is, the material objects on the island, that we lose sight of existence itself.
A brief silence. Heads turned toward Philip.
Exactly,
responded Philip with a hint of enthusiasm in his tone.
My view exactly. The idea is that one has to be aware of losing oneself in life's distractions. Heidegger called it falling or being absorbed in the everydayness of life. Now, I know you can't abide Heidegger, Pam, but I don't believe his misguided politics should be permitted to deprive us of the gift of his philosophical insights. So to paraphrase Heidegger, falling into everydayness results in one's becoming unfree, like the sheep.
Like Pam, Philip continued, I believe the parable warns us against attachment and urges us to stay attuned to the miracle of being, not to worry about how things are, but to be in a state of wonderment that things are, that things exist at all.
Now I think I'm getting your meaning, said Bonnie. But it's cold, abstract. What comfort is there in that? For Julius, for anyone.
For me, there is comfort in the idea that my death informs my life. Philip spoke with uncharacteristic fervor as he continued. There is comfort in the idea of not allowing my core being to be devoured by trivialities, by insignificant successes or failures, by what I possess, by concerns about popularity, who likes me, who doesn't. For me, there is comfort in the state of remaining free to appreciate the miracle of being.
Your voice sounds energized, said Stuart. But I also think this seems steely and bloodless. It's cold consolation. Makes me shiver.
The members were puzzled. They sensed that Philip had something of value to offer, but, as usual, were confused by his bizarre manner. After a brief silence, Tony asked Julius,
Does this work for you? I mean, in terms of offering you something. Does it help you in some way?
It doesn't work for me, Tony. Yet, as I've said, he turned toward Philip, You're reaching out to give me something that works for you. I'm aware, too, this is the second time you've offered me something I've not been able to make use of. And that must be frustrating for you.
Philip nodded but remained silent. A second time? I don't recall another time, said Pam. Did it happen when I was away?
Several heads shook no. No one else remembered a first time, and Pam asked Julius,
Are there blanks that need to be filled in here?
There's old history between Philip and me, said Julius. A lot of puzzlement today could be removed by relating this history. But I feel it's up to you, Philip, when you're ready.
I'm willing for all to be discussed, said Philip.
You have carte blanche.
No, what I mean is, it's not for me to do that. To paraphrase your words, it would be a richer exercise if you would discuss it yourself. I think it's your call and your responsibility.
Philip tilted his head upward, closed his eyes, and, using the same tone and manner as when reciting a memorized passage, began.
25 years ago, I consulted Julius for what is now termed sexual addiction. I was predatory. I was driven. I was insatiable. I thought of little else. My whole being was caught up in the pursuit of women. New women, always new women. Because once I bedded a woman, I rapidly lost interest in her. It was as though the epicenter of my existence was that moment of ejaculating inside the woman. And once that happened, I had a brief respite from my compulsion. But soon, sometimes only hours later, I felt the call to prowl again. Sometimes I had 2 or 3 women in a day. I was desperate. I wanted to get my mind out of the trough, to think about other things, to touch some of the great minds of the past. I was educated in chemistry then, but I yearned for real wisdom. I sought help, the best and most expensive available, and met with Julius weekly, sometimes twice weekly for 3 years, without benefit. Philip paused. The group stirred. Julius asked, "How is this going for you, Philip? Can you go farther, or is it enough for one day?"
"I'm fine," replied Philip.
"With your closed eyes, it's hard to read you," said Bonnie. "I'm wondering if you keep them closed because you fear disapproval."
"No. I close my eyes to look within and collect my thoughts. And surely I've made it clear that only my own approval matters to me."
Again there settled onto the group that strange, otherworldly sense of Philip's untouchability. Tony tried to dispel it by whispering loudly,
"Nice try, Bonnie."
Without opening his eyes, Philip continued,
"Not too long after I gave up therapy with Julius, I inherited a fair sum of money from the maturation of a trust account my father had set up for me. The money enabled me to leave my profession as a chemist and devote myself to reading all of Western philosophy, in part because of my enduring interest in that field, but primarily because I believe that somewhere in the collective wisdom of the world's great thinkers, I would find a cure for my condition. I felt at home in philosophy, and soon realized that I had found my true calling. I applied and was accepted in the philosophy doctoral program at Columbia. It was at that time that Pam had the misfortune of crossing my path." Philip, eyes still closed, paused and inhaled deeply. All eyes were on him except for furtive glances toward Pam, who stared at the floor. "As time went by, I chose to concentrate my attention on the trinity of truly great philosophers, Plato, Kant, and Schopenhauer. But in the final analysis, it was only Schopenhauer who offered me help. Not only were his words pure gold for me, but I sensed a strong affinity with his person. As a rational being, I cannot accept the idea of reincarnation in its vulgar sense. But if I had lived before, it would have been as Arthur Schopenhauer. Simply knowing of his existence has tempered the ache of my isolation. After reading and rereading his work for several years, I found that I had overcome my sexual problems. By the time I received my doctorate, my father's bequest was exhausted, and I needed to earn a living. I taught at a few places around the country and a few years ago moved back to San Francisco to accept a position at Coastal University. Eventually I lost interest in teaching because I never found students worthy of me or my subject. And then, about 3 years ago, it occurred to me that,
since philosophy had healed me, I might be able to use philosophy to heal others. I enrolled in and completed a counseling curriculum, and then began a small clinical practice. And that brings me to the present.
Julius was useless to you, said Pam. Yet you contacted him again. Why?
I didn't. He contacted me.
Pam muttered. Oh, yeah, right.
Out of the blue, Julius contacted you.
No, no, Pam, said Bonnie. That part is true. Julius confirmed it while you were away. I can't fill you in on it because I've never really understood it myself.
Right, let me come in here, said Julius. I'll reconstruct it as best I can. The first few days after receiving the bad news from my doctor, I was staggered and tried to find a way to come to terms with having a lethal cancer. One evening, I got into a very morose mood as I thought about the meaning of my life. I got to thinking about being destined to slip into nothingness and remaining there forever. And that being so, then what difference did anyone or any activity make? I can't remember the whole chain of my morbid thinking, but I knew I had to clutch some kind of meaning or I would drown on dry land, then and there. As I surveyed my life, I realized that I had experienced meaning, and that it always involved stepping outside of myself, helping others to live and to fulfill themselves. More clearly than ever before, I realized the centrality of my work as a therapist. And then I thought for hours about those I had helped. All my patients, old and new, paraded through my imagination. Many I knew I had helped. But had I had an enduring impact on their lives? That was the question that plagued me. I think I told the rest of the group before Pam returned that I had to know the answer to this question so badly, I decided to contact some of my old patients to find out whether I had truly made a difference. Seems crazy, I know. Then, while browsing through the charts of my long-ago patients, I also began thinking of those I had failed to help. What had happened to them, I wondered. Could I have done more? And then the thought, the wishful thought, arose that maybe some of my failures were late bloomers. Maybe they had gotten some delayed benefit from our work together. Then my eye fell upon Philip's chart, and I remember saying to myself, if you want failure, there is failure. There was someone you really didn't help. You couldn't even make a dent in his problems. From that moment on, I had an irresistible impulse to contact Philip and find out what happened to him, to see if, in some way, I had been useful to him after all.
So that's how it came about that you called him, said Pam. But how did it come about that he entered the group?
You want to pick it up from here, Philip? Said Julius.
I believe it would be a richer exercise if you continued,
said Philip with the slightest trace of a smile on his lips. Julius quickly filled the group in on the subsequent events. Philip's appraisal that his therapy had been without value, and that Schopenhauer had been his real therapist, the email invitation to the lecture, Philip's request for supervision.
I don't get it, Philip, interrupted Tony. If you didn't get anything from Julius in therapy, then why the hell would you want his supervision?
Julius posed that exact question several times, said Philip. My answer is that even though he didn't help me, I could still appreciate his superior skills. Perhaps I was a recalcitrant, resistive patient, or perhaps my particular type of problem would not yield to his particular approach.
Okay, got it, said Tony.
I interrupted you, Julius. I'm about finished. I agreed to become his supervisor with one condition, that he first spend 6 months in my therapy group.
I don't think you've ever explained why you made that condition, said Rebecca.
I observed the way he related to me and to his students and told him that his impersonal and uncaring manner would interfere with his becoming a good therapist,
Is that your view of it, Philip?
Your precise words to me were, how can you be a therapist when you don't know what the fuck is going on between you and other people?
Bingo, said Pam. Sounds like Julius, all right, said Bonnie.
Sounds like Julius when his buttons are being pushed, said Stuart. Were you pushing his buttons?
Not intentionally, replied Philip. I'm still not clear, Julius, said Rebecca. I understand why you called Philip, and why you advised him to get group therapy. But why did you put him in your group, or agree to supervise him? You have plenty on your plate now. Why take on this additional task?
You guys are tough today. That's the big question, and I'm not sure I can answer it. But it's got something to do with redemption and setting things right.
I know a lot of this discussion was to fill me in, and I appreciate that, said Pam. I have just one more query. You said Philip twice offered you comfort, or tried to. I still haven't heard about the first time.
Right, we started toward there but never got to it, Julius responded. I attended one of Philip's lectures, and gradually understood that he had constructed it specifically to offer me some help. He discussed at length a passage from a novel in which a dying man obtained much consolation from reading a passage by Schopenhauer.
Which novel? Asked Pam.
Buddenbrooks, replied Julius.
And it wasn't helpful? Why not? Asked Bonnie.
For several reasons. First, Philip's mode of giving me comfort was very indirect, much like the way he just presented the passage by Epictetus.
Julius, said Tony,
I'm not being a smartass, but wouldn't it be better to speak directly to Philip? Guess who I learned this from?
Thanks, Tony. You are 100% right. Julius turned to face Philip.
Your mode of offering me counsel in the course of a lecture was off-putting. So indirect and so public. And so unexpected, because we had just spent an hour in private face-to-face talk in which you seemed utterly indifferent to my condition. That was one thing. And the other was the actual content. I can't repeat the passage here. I don't have your photographic memory. But essentially it described a dying patriarch having an epiphany in which the boundaries dissolved between himself and others. As a result, he was comforted by the unity of all life, and the idea that after death he would return to the life force whence he came, and hence retain his connectedness with all living things. That about right?
Julius looked at Philip, who nodded.
Well, as I tried to tell you before, Philip, that idea offers me no comfort. Zero. If my own consciousness is extinguished, that it matters little to me that my life energy or my bodily molecules or my DNA persists in deep space. And if connectivity is the quest, then I'd rather do it in person, in the flesh. So, he turned and scanned the group and then faced Pam. That was the first consolation Philip offered, and the parable in your hands is the second. After a brief silence, Julius added, I'm feeling I've been doing too much talking today. How are you all responding to what's been happening so far?
I'm interested, said Rebecca.
Yeah, said Bonnie.
This is some pretty high-level stuff going on, said Tony. But I'm staying with it.
I'm aware, noted Stuart, of ongoing tension here.
Tension between, asked Tony.
Between Pam and Philip, of course.
And lots between Julius and Philip, added Gil, again taking up Philip's cause. I'm wondering, Philip, do you feel listened to? Do you feel your contributions get the consideration they merit?
It seems to me that,
Philip was unusually tentative, but soon regained his characteristic fluency.
Isn't it precipitous to dismiss so quickly?
Who are you talking to? Asked Tony.
Right, answered Philip.
Julius?
isn't it precipitous to dismiss so quickly a concept that has offered consolation to much of humanity for millennia? It is Epictetus's idea, and Schopenhauer's as well, that excessive attachment either to material goods, to other individuals, or even attachment to the concept of I, is the major source of human suffering. And doesn't it follow that such suffering can be ameliorated by avoiding the attachment? Indeed, these ideas are at the very heart of the Buddha's teaching as well.
That's a good point, Philip, and I will take it to heart. What I hear you saying is that you're giving me good stuff which I dismiss out of hand, and that leaves you feeling unvalued, right?
I said nothing about feeling unvalued. Not out loud. I'm intuiting that. It would be such a human response. I have a hunch if you will look inside, you'll find it there.
Pam, you're rolling your eyes, said Rebecca.
Is this talk about attachment reminding you of your meditation retreat in India?
Julius, Philip, both of you missed the post-group coffee when Pam described her time at the ashram.
Yep, exactly, said Pam.
I had a bellyful of talk about the relinquishment of all attachments, including the inane idea that we can sever our attachment to our personal ego. I ended up with strong feelings that it was all so life-negating. And that parable Philip handed out? What's the message? I mean, what kind of voyage? What kind of life is it if you're so focused on the departure that you can't enjoy your surroundings and can't enjoy other people?
And that's what I see in you, Philip.
Pam turned to address him directly.
Your solution to your problems is a pseudo-solution. It's no solution at all. It's something else. It's a relinquishment of life. You're not in life. You don't really listen to others. And when I hear you speak, I don't feel I'm listening to a living, breathing person.
Pam, Gil sprang to Philip's defense. Talk about listening. I'm not sure you do much listening. Did you hear that he was miserable years ago? That he had overwhelming problems and impulses? That he did not respond to 3 full years of therapy with Julius? That he did what you just did last month, what any of us would do, seek another method? That he finally got help from a different approach, one which is no freakish New Age pseudo-solution? And that now he's trying to offer something to Julius by using the approach that helped him?
The group was silenced by Gil's outburst. After a few moments, Tony said,
Gil, you are something else today. Sticking it to my girl, Pam. I don't like that, but man, I sure do like the way you're talking here. Hope it rubs off on your home life with Rose.
Philip, said Rebecca, I want to apologize for being so dismissive earlier today. I want to say that I'm changing my mind about this story by Epictetus.
Epictetus, said Philip in a softer tone.
Epictetus, thanks, Rebecca continued. The more I think about it, the whole thing about attachment throws a light on some of my stuff. I think I am suffering from excessive attachment, not to things or possessions, but to my looks. All my life I've had a free pass because of a pretty face. Got lots of affirmation, prom queen, homecoming queen, beauty contests. And now that it's fading.
Fading? Said Bonnie.
Just pass the faded remnants onto me.
Me too. I'll trade you any time and throw in all my jewelry, and kids if I had any, said Pam.
I appreciate that. I really do, but it's all relative, Rebecca went on. I am too attached. I am my face. And now that it's become less, I feel I am less. I'm having a lot of trouble giving up my free pass.
One of Schopenhauer's formulations that helped me, said Philip, was the idea that relative happiness stems from 3 sources. What one is, what one has, and what one represents in the eyes of others. He urges that we focus only on the first
and do not bank on the second and third, on having and our reputation. Because we have no control over those two, they can and will be taken away from us. Just as your inevitable aging is taking away your beauty. In fact, having has a reverse factor. He said, what we have often starts to have us.
Interesting, Philip. All three parts of that, what you are, have, and stand for in the eyes of others, it's home for me. I've lived too much of my life for that last part, what others will think of me. Let me confess another secret. My magic perfume. I've never talked to anyone about this, but ever since I can remember, I've daydreamed about manufacturing a perfume called Rebecca, made up of my essence which lingers indefinitely and causes anyone who inhales it to think of my beauty. Rebecca, you're taking so many more risks now. I love it, said Pam.
Me too, said Stuart.
But let me tell you something that's never registered before.
I like to look at you, but I'm realizing now that your good looks are a barrier to seeing or knowing you. Maybe even as much of a barrier as when a woman is ugly or misshapen.
Well, that's a shocker. Thanks, Stuart.
Rebecca, I want you to know, said Julius, that I too am touched by your trusting us with your daydream about the perfume. It points out what a vicious circle you've set up. You confuse your beauty with your essence, and when that happens, as Stuart points out, is that others do not relate to your essence but to your beauty.
A vicious circle which leaves me doubting whether there's anything there. I'm still struck by your phrase the other week, Julius. The beautiful empty woman. That's me in spades.
Except the vicious circle may be breaking down, said Gil. I know I've seen more of you, that is, something deeper, in the last few weeks than in the whole previous year. Yeah, me too, agreed Tony. And I'm being serious now. I want to say I'm really sorry about counting out money when you told us about that time in Las Vegas. I acted like a real jerk.
Apology noted and accepted, said Rebecca.
You've gotten a lot of feedback today, Rebecca, said Julius. How are you feeling about it?
I feel great. It's good. I feel people are treating me differently.
It's not us, said Tony. It's you. Put real stuff in, get real stuff out.
Put real stuff in, get real stuff out. I like that, Tony, said Rebecca. Hey, you're getting good at this therapy business. Maybe I should start counting out money. What are your fees?
Tony smiled broadly. Since I'm on a roll, let me give you my guess, Julius, about why you went out of your way to work with Philip again. Maybe when you first saw Philip years ago, you were closer to that state of mind you told us about last week. You know, having strong sex desires for other women. Julius nodded. Go on. Well, here's what I'm wondering. If you had issues similar to Philip's, not the same, but something in that ballpark, would that have gotten in the way of your therapy with him? Julius sat up straight in his chair. Philip, too, straightened up. You are sure catching my attention, Tony. Now I'm beginning to remember why therapists are hesitant to reveal themselves. I mean, it doesn't go away. What you reveal comes back to haunt you again and again. Sorry, Julius, I definitely didn't mean to put you on the spot. No, it's okay. I really mean that. I'm not complaining. Maybe I'm just stalling. Your observation is good. Maybe it's too good, too close, and I'm resisting a bit. Julius paused and thought a moment. Okay, here's what comes up for me. I remember that I was surprised and dismayed that I hadn't helped Philip. I should have helped him. When we began, I would have taken a big bet that I would have helped him a lot. I thought I had an inside track on helping him. I was sure that my own personal experience would grease the rails of therapy.
Maybe, said Tony. Maybe that's why you invited Philip into this group. Give another try, get another chance, right?
You took the words out of my mouth, said Julius.
I was just going to say that. This may be the reason why a few months ago, when I was wondering about who I helped and who I didn't, I got so fixated on Philip. In fact, when Philip came to mine, I began to lose interest in contacting other patients. Hey, look at the time. I hate to bring this meeting to an end, but we've got to stop. Good meeting. I know I've got a lot to think about. Tony, you opened up some things for me. Thanks. So, said Tony with a grin, am I excused from paying today?
Blessed is he who gives, said Julius.
But who knows? Keep on like this, and that day may come. After leaving the group room, the members chattered on the outside steps of Julius's home before dispersing. Only Tony and Pam headed toward the coffee shop.
Pam was fixated on Philip.
She was not mollified by Philip's statement that she had been unlucky to have met him. Moreover, she hated his compliment on her interpretation of the parable, and hated even more that she had enjoyed getting it. She worried that the group was swinging over to Philip. Away from her, away from Julius. Tony felt elated. He voted himself the MVP, the meeting's most valuable player. Maybe he'd skip the bar scene tonight. Try to read one of the books Pam had given him. Gil watched Pam and Tony walk down the street together. He, and Philip, of course, were the only ones Pam had not hugged at the end of the meeting. Had he crossed her too much? Gil turned his attention to tomorrow's wine-tasting event, one of Rose's big nights. A group of Rose's friends always got together at this time of the year for a sampling of the year's best wines. How to negotiate that? Just swish the wine and spit it out? Pretty tough to pull that off. Or come right out with the truth. He thought of his AA sponsor. He knew how the conversation between them would go. Sponsor.
Where are your priorities? Skip the event, go to a meeting.
Gil. But wine tasting is the reason these friends get together.
Sponsor.
Is it?
Suggest another activity.
Gil. Won't work. They won't do it.
Sponsor.
Then get new friends.
Gil.
Rose won't like it.
Sponsor.
So?
Rebecca said to herself,
real stuff in, real stuff out. Real stuff in, real stuff out. Must remember that.
She smiled when she thought about Tony counting his money when she had talked about her flirtation with whoredom. Secretly, she had gotten a kick out of that. Was it bad faith to accept an apology from him? Bonnie, as always, hated to see the meeting come to an end. She was alive those 90 minutes. The rest of her life seemed so tepid. Why was that? Why must librarians lead dull lives? Then she thought about Philip's statement about what you are, what you have, and what you represent to others. Intriguing. Stuart relished the meeting. He was entering full-bodied into the group. He repeated to himself the words he had said to Rebecca about how her look served as a barrier to knowing her, and that he had recently seen something deeper than her skin. That was good. That was good. And telling Philip that his cold kind of consolation had made him shiver. That was being more than a camera. And then there was the way he had pointed out the tension between Pam and Philip. No. No, that was camera stuff. On his walk home, Philip struggled to avoid thinking of the meeting, but the events were too heady to screen out. In a few minutes, he caved in and permitted his thoughts free rein. Old Epictetus had caught their attention. He always does. Then he imagined hands reaching out and faces turned toward him. Gil had become his champion, but not to be taken seriously.
Gil wasn't for him, but instead was against Pam. Trying to learn how to defend himself against her, and Rose, and all other women. Rebecca had liked what he had said. Her handsome face lingered briefly in his mind. And then he thought of Tony, the tattoos, the bruised cheek. He had never met anyone like him, a real primitive, but a primitive who was beginning to comprehend a world beyond everydayness. And Julius, was he losing his sharpness? How could he defend attachment while acknowledging his problems of overinvestment in Philip as a patient? Philip felt jittery, uncomfortable in his skin. He sensed that he was in danger of unraveling. Why had he told Pam that she was unlucky to have met him? Is that why she had spoken his name so often in the meeting and demanded that he face her? His former debased self was hovering like a ghost. He sensed its presence, thirsting for life. Philip quieted his mind and slipped into a walking meditation. 33. To the learned men and philosophers of Europe. For you, a windbag like Fichte is the equal of Kant, the greatest thinker of all time. And a worthless, barefaced charlatan like Hegel is considered to be a profound thinker. I have therefore not written for you. Suffering, rage, perseverance. If Arthur Schopenhauer were alive today, would he be a candidate for psychotherapy? Absolutely. He was highly symptomatic. In About Myself, he laments that nature endowed him with an anxious disposition and a suspiciousness, sensitiveness, vehemence, and pride in a measure that is hardly compatible with the equanimity of a philosopher. In graphic language, he describes his symptoms. Inherited from my father is the anxiety which I myself curse and combat with all the force of my will. As a young man, I was tormented by imaginary illnesses. When I was studying in Berlin, I thought I was a consumptive. I was haunted by the fear of being pressed into military service. From Naples, I was driven by the fear of smallpox, and from Berlin by the fear of cholera. In Verona, I was seized by the idea I had taken poisoned snuff. In Mannheim, I was overcome by an indescribable feeling of fear without any external cause. For years, I was haunted by the fear of criminal proceedings. If there was a noise at night, I jumped out of bed and seized sword and pistol that I always had ready loaded. I always have an anxious concern that causes me to look for dangers where none exist. It magnifies the tiniest vexation and makes association with people most difficult for me. Hoping to quell his suspiciousness and chronic fear, he employed a host of precautions and rituals. He hid gold coins and valuable interest-bearing coupons in old letters and other secret places for emergency use. He filed personal notes under false headings to confuse snoopers. He was fastidiously tidy. He requested that he always be served by the same bank clerk. He allowed no one to touch his statue of the Buddha. His sexual drive was too strong for comfort, and even as a young man, he deplored being controlled by his animal passions. At the age of 36, a mysterious course of illness confined him to his room for an entire year. A physician and medical historian suggested in 1906 that his illness had been syphilis, basing the diagnosis only upon the nature of the medication prescribed, coupled with Schopenhauer's history of unusually great sexual activity. Arthur longed to be released from the grip of sexuality. He savored his moments of serenity when he was able to observe the world with calm, in spite of the lust tormenting his corporeal self. He compared sexual passion to the daylight which obscures the stars. As he aged, he welcomed the decline of sexual passion and the accompanying tranquility. Since his deepest passion was his work,
His strongest and most persistent fear was that he should lose the financial means enabling him to live the life of the intellect. Even into old age, he blessed the memory of his father, who had made such a life possible, and he spent much time and energy guarding his money and pondering his investments. Accordingly, he was alarmed by any unrest threatening his investments and became ultra-conservative in his politics. The 1848 rebellion, which swept over Germany as well as the rest of Europe, terrified him. When soldiers entered his building to gain a vantage point from which to fire on the rebellious populace in the street, he offered them his opera glasses to increase the accuracy of their rifle fire. In his will, 12 years later, he left almost his entire estate to a fund established for the welfare of Prussian soldiers disabled fighting that rebellion. His anxiety-driven letters about business matters were often laced with anger and threats. When the banker who handled the Schopenhauer family money suffered a disastrous financial setback and, to escape bankruptcy, offered all his investors only a small fraction of their investment, Schopenhauer threatened him with such draconian legal consequences that the banker returned to him 70% of his money, while paying other investors, including Schopenhauer's mother and sister, an even smaller portion than originally proposed. His abuse of letters to his publisher eventually resulted in a permanent rupture of their relationship. The publisher wrote, "I shall not accept any letters from you which in their divine rudeness and rusticity suggest a coachman rather than a philosopher. I only hope that my fears that by printing your work I am printing only waste paper will not come true." Schopenhauer's rage was legendary. Rage at financiers who handled his investments, at publishers who could not sell his books, at the dolts who attempted to engage him in conversation, at the bipeds who regarded themselves his equal, at those who coughed at concerts, and the press for ignoring him. But the real rage, the white-hot rage whose vehemence still astounds us and made Schopenhauer a pariah in his intellectual community, was his rage toward contemporary thinkers, particularly the two leading lights of 19th-century philosophy, Fichte and Hegel. In a book published 20 years after Hegel succumbed to cholera during the Berlin epidemic, he referred to Hegel as a commonplace, inane, loathsome, repulsive, and ignorant charlatan who, with unparalleled effrontery, compiled a system of crazy nonsense that was trumpeted abroad as immortal wisdom by his mercenary followers. Such intemperate outbursts about other philosophers cost him heavily. In 1837, he was awarded first prize for an essay on the freedom of the will, in a competition sponsored by the Royal Norwegian Society for Learning. Schopenhauer showed a childlike delight in the prize. It was his very first honor, and greatly vexed the Norwegian Council in Frankfurt by impatiently clamoring for his medal. However, the very next year, his essay on the basis of morality submitted to a competition sponsored by the Royal Danish Society for Learning met a different fate. Though the argument of his essay was excellent, and though it was the only essay submitted, the judges refused to reward him the prize because of his intemperate remarks about Hegel. The judges commented, "We cannot pass over in silence the fact that several outstanding philosophers of the modern age are referred to in so improper a manner as to cause serious and just offense." Over the years, many have agreed entirely with Schopenhauer's opinion that Hegel's prose is unnecessarily obfuscating. In fact, he is so difficult to read that an old joke circulating around philosophy departments is that the most vexing and awesome philosophical question is not, "Does life have meaning?" or "What is consciousness?" but "Who will teach Hegel this year?" Still, the level, the vehemence of Schopenhauer's rage set him apart from all other critics. The more his work was neglected, the shriller he became, which in turn caused further neglect and, for many, made him an object of mockery.
Yet despite his anxiety and loneliness, Schopenhauer survived and continued to exhibit all the outward signs of personal self-sufficiency. And he persevered in his work, remaining a productive scholar until the end of his life. He never lost faith in himself. He compared himself to a young oak tree who looked as ordinary and unimportant as other plants. But let him alone. He will not die. Time will come and bring those who know how to value him. He predicted his genius would ultimately have a great influence upon future generations of thinkers. And he was right. All that he predicted has come to pass. 34. Seen from the standpoint of youth, life is an endlessly long future. From that of old age, it resembles a very brief past. When we sail away, objects on the shore become ever smaller and more difficult to recognize and distinguish. So, too, is it with our past years with all their events and activities. As time raced by, Julius looked forward with increasing anticipation to the weekly group meeting. Perhaps his experiences in the group were more poignant because the weeks of his one good year were running out. But it was not just the events of the group. Everything in his life, large and small, appeared more tender and vivid. Of course, his weeks had always been numbered, but the numbers had seemed so large, so stretched into a forever future, that he had never confronted the end of weeks. Visible endings always cause us to break. Readers zip through the 1,000 pages of the Brothers Karamazov until there are only a dozen remaining pages, and then they suddenly decelerate, savoring each paragraph slowly, sucking the nectar from each phrase, each word. Scarcity of days caused Julius to treasure time. More and more he fell into astonished contemplation of the miraculous flow of everyday events. Recently he had read a piece by an entomologist who explored the cosmos existing in a roped-off 2x2 piece of turf. Digging deeply, he described his sense of awe at the dynamic, teeming world of predators and prey, nematodes, millipedes, springtails, armor-plated beetles, and spiderlings. If perspective is attuned, attention rapt, and knowledge vast, then one enters everydayness in a perpetual state of wonderment. So it was for Julius in the group. His fears about the recurrence of his melanoma had receded, and his panics grew less frequent. Perhaps his greater comfort stemmed from taking his doctor's estimate of one good year too literally, almost as a guarantee. More likely, though, his mode of life was the active emollient. Following Zarathustra's path, he'd shared his ripeness, transcended himself by reaching out to others, and lived in a manner that he would be willing to repeat perpetually throughout eternity. He had always remained curious about the direction the therapy groups would take the following week. Now, with his last good year visibly shrinking, all feelings were intensified. His curiosity had evolved into an eager, childlike anticipation of the next meeting. He remembered how, years ago, when he taught group therapy, the beginning students complained of boredom as they observed 90 minutes of talking heads. Later, when they learned how to listen to the drama of each patient's life, and to appreciate the exquisitely complex interaction between members, boredom dissolved and every student was in place early awaiting the next installment. The looming end of the group propelled members to address their core issues with increased ardor. A visible end to therapy always has that result. And for that reason, pioneer practitioners like Otto Rank and Carl Rogers often set a termination date at the very onset of therapy. Stewart did more work in those months than in 3 previous years of therapy. Perhaps Philip had jump-started Stewart by serving as a mirror. He saw parts of himself in Philip's misanthropy and realized that every member of the group, except the 2 of them,
took pleasure in the meetings, and considered the group a refuge, a place of support and caring. Only he and Philip attended under duress. Philip, in order to obtain supervision from Julius, and he because of his wife's ultimatum. At one meeting, Pam commented that the group never formed a true circle, because Stuart's chair was invariably set back a bit, sometimes only a couple of inches, but big inches. Others agreed. They had all felt the seating asymmetry, but never connected it to Stuart's avoidance of closeness. In another meeting, Stuart launched into a familiar grievance as he described his wife's attachment to her father, a physician who rose from chairman of a surgery department to medical school dean to president of a university. When Stuart continued, as he had in previous meetings, to discuss the impossibility of ever winning his wife's regard because she continually compared him to her father, Julius interrupted to inquire whether he was aware that he had often told this story before. After Stuart responded, "But surely we should be bringing up issues that continue to be bothersome, shouldn't we?" Julius then asked a powerful question. "How did you think we would feel about your repetition? I imagine you'd find it tedious or boring." Think about that, Stuart. What's the payoff for you in being tedious or boring? And then think about why you've never developed empathy for your listeners. Stuart did think about that a great deal during the following week, and reported feeling astonished to realize how little he ever considered that question. "I know my wife often finds me tedious. Her favorite term for me is absent. And I guess the group is telling me the same thing. You know, I think I've put my empathy into deep storage." A short while later, Stuart opened up a central problem. His ongoing, inexplicable anger toward his 12-year-old son. Tony opened a Pandora's box by asking, "What were you like when you were your son's age?" Stuart described growing up in poverty. His father had died when he was 8, and his mother, who worked 2 jobs, was never home when he returned from school. Hence, he had been a latchkey kid, preparing his own dinner, wearing the same soiled clothes to school day after day. For the most part, he had succeeded in suppressing the memory of his childhood, but his son's presence propelled him back to horrors long forgotten. "Blaming my son is crazy," he said. "But I just keep feeling envy and resentment when I see his privileged life." It was Tony who helped crack Stuart's anger with an effective reframing intervention. "What about spending some time feeling proud at providing that better life for your son?" Almost everyone made progress. Julius had seen this before. When groups reach a state of ripeness, all the members seem to get better at once. Bonnie struggled to come to terms with a central paradox. Her rage toward her ex-husband for having left her, and her relief that she was out of a relationship with a man that she so thoroughly disliked. Gil attended daily AA meetings, 70 meetings in 70 days. But his marital difficulties increased, rather than decreased with his sobriety. That, of course, was no mystery to Julius. Whenever one spouse improves in therapy, the homeostasis of the marital relationship is upset and, if the marriage is to stay solvent, the other spouse must change as well. Gil and Rose had begun couples therapy, but Gil wasn't convinced that Rose could change. However, he was no longer terrified at the thought of ending the marriage. For the first time, he truly understood one of Julius's favorite bon mots. "The only way you can save your marriage is to be willing and able to leave it." Tony worked at an astonishing pace, as though Julius's depleting strength were seeping directly into him. With Pam's encouragement, strongly reinforced by everyone else in the group, he decided to stop complaining of being ignorant and instead do something about it. Get an education, and enrolled in 3 night courses at the local community college. However thrilling and gratifying these widespread changes, Julius's central attention remained riveted on Philip and Pam.
Why their relationship had taken on such importance for him was unclear.